Senate Finance will come to order. It's a pleasure to have Senator Bundy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, and Co-Chair Wilken. I'm Senator Green, and we're here on Friday, and we started a little later this morning than usual, but we were waiting for some documents to get over here and wanted to give the people time to get them over here. It's a pleasure for me to introduce a group that's in the audience today, and it's the Academy Charter School, who's visiting from Palmer, Alaska. If you would all stand up, please, and then your sponsors can raise their hands, and all you guys. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it, and we hope you have a great day here, and we'll see you on the Senate floor after this meeting's over. Thank you very much. Okay, let's see, we had been reviewing the charts yesterday, and there's a new group to pass out, and then Dan and Sherry have some information to bring us today, or do we want to go ahead and do the Dyson questions first?
Madam Chair, it's up to you. We'll might take us a second to get the computer up and running. Okay. To present the additional graphical material.
Okay.
Is there someone who can assist on the computer getting it, make sure it's up and running?
No.
You need a password?
The answer I don't have.
Okay. You don't want to watch me try to hack into it on the screen here. See how easily to hack.
Get one of those young people to hack it for you.
Get one of the students.
One of those ones from the Kuskokwim campus that hacked into the university.
Yeah. If we just shut that university in Fairbanks down, they couldn't hack in up there.
Okay.
This is one way to do it.
The smart students aren't the Kuskokwim.
Okay, in your packet there, you'll find a document from Fred Dyson. And he just asked some questions. So while we're waiting for this to get going, Dan, if you want to just go ahead and start reading from the top there. And
Certainly. He's
talking about after a cursory review of version P and after Dan Dickinson's testimony yesterday, I have the following concerns and our questions. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a consultant with the Department of Revenue in the Governor's Office on the matters before you. Looking at page 2 of the bill, lines 20 through 23. What we see is this is section 3.
Sorry.
A nice image there. This is in section 3 on line 20, and what we're amending is AS 4320, which is the income tax statute. So what the line says here is, in computing the tax under this chapter, the taxpayer is not entitled to deduct any taxes based on or measured by net income. The taxpayer may deduct the tax levied and paid under AS 4355. So Senator Dyson's question is, may deduct it from what? And the answer is, in calculating their worldwide income for purposes of AS 4320 or for the income tax. So this is, because this fits in, this is section C, I don't have the income tax statute with me, but in general, in 20, these are listing the deductions that you can make to calculate your income. And again, just to make the distinction, a tax measured by or a tax on or measured by net income is not a deductible expense for income tax purposes. So in other words, if you're looking at what you're trying to do is figure out what a company's worldwide income is, so you want to know all the sort of excise taxes and things like that they've deducted, but what you don't want to know is when other people who are trying to measure the same thing, if they've deducted a tax, that would get you into a circular situation. So that's why this says that this tax is a production tax, it's an excise tax, and the taxpayer may deduct it. Page 3, line 21. A question of whether there should be a comma there. I'm going to leave that up to the drafters. Probably if it read out loud, that is correct. That might be an appropriate place. This is language that generally is carried over from the current statute. It just continues and adds some conditions there. The next question is on page 3, line 29. It refers to the department. The question is, which department in other locations, such as 16, Section 15, and there's some other ones that refer to the Department of Natural Resources. In general, if you look at section, we are in Section 5, which begins on line 14, and this will be AS 4355. When we are in 4355 and it refers to the department, that will be the Department of Revenue. And generally, when we are referring to the Department of Natural Resources, it will list that full name. So for example, under some of the credits where there's some geological tests or tests that need to be made, those are deferred to the Department of Natural Resources. They would have the personnel to deal with those.
Okay.
So we can certainly double check, but I think in general, small D refers to the Department of Revenue throughout, and big D, Department of Natural Resources, will be put in when it refers to them.
Yes, sir. I'm
certainly beyond my pay grade here, but I'm not sure that a department being a specific reference to a department ought to be just figured out by whether or not it's capitalized. You know, maybe ought to be some other way of delineating it.
I think what Dan was referring to, that AS 43 pertains to revenue. And therefore, in AS 43, the department refers to revenue. If you were in another chapter, I mean, if you were in something that had to do with HESS, after two or three references, it refers to the department means Health, Education, Social Services.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I don't know if the Assistant Attorney General is on the phone, but I believe in the definition section for this chapter, it says, D, department refers to the Department of Natural Resources, commissioner refers to the, Department of Revenue, commissioner refers to the commissioner of Department of Revenue.
Okay.
Just as long as we're consistent and clear, that's fine with me.
Sure. Good. And the next one?
Next one says on page 4, lines 5 and 6, this section of the bill, this increases the royalty tax on gas from the Senate Resources version of 1.5 of the gross for cooking the gas to 7.5% of gross production for gas anywhere in the state. For non-cook inlet, the increase is from the previous 5% to 7.5. Isn't that a pretty big increase for cook inlet gas, especially when we want more cook inlet gas? And it appears that this change increases the private royalty tax for gas. Do we really want to increase the tax on the gas? Let me address the technical questions first. On page 4, lines 5 and 6, this is actually needs to be read in the context of page 3, line 29, and the last three lines on page 3, and the first two lines on page 4. If you recall, what section E, which begins on line 15 of page 3, is doing is dealing with a tax, Section F, beginning on line 20, dealing with is the tax on a private royalty interest. Again, this constitutes less than 1% of the royalty interest in the state, but there's a special tax identified for those royalty interests. The department was concerned that in those private royalty contracts between an oil company and a private lessor, you could create a situation where you would say, well, let's say we've always had a 12.5% interest, but instead we're going to double it to a 24% interest, but then we'll have some mechanism here that we re-equalize when we calculate our costs. So when it comes time to pay the tax, suddenly instead of 12.5% receiving the lower rate, 25% would receive the lower rate. So what it says on page 3, line 29, section 3, is if the department determines that for purposes of reducing the producer's tax liability, in other words, they've entered into tax-motivated behavior, the producer has received or will receive consideration from the lessor, the private royalty owner, offsetting all or a part of the producer's royalty obligation other than a deduction under AS 4355-020D of the amount of the tax paid, then the tax rates that you refer to will kick in. So in other words, What's happening here is this provision is a backup provision. If the department believes that there's been collusion between a royalty owner and a the company that's developing that royalty share, then those rates kick in. They're meant to approximate the tax that would be paid otherwise. They don't do it precisely correctly. I think you've correctly observed that. But these rates will not apply, and we hope we never find collusion, so we hope they never apply. They're only meant to be a backup. The tax itself on the Cook Inlet gas or any hydrocarbons produced in, gas produced anywhere in the state is going to be calculated. You need, unfortunately, to go to two places in the statute. The first would be on line 3, page 3, lines 27 and lines 25. So if it is on oil, it will be 5%, and if it is on gas, it will be 1.6%. But again, those are both on the gross value instead of the net. So those rates are carved out specifically for private royalty interests. For the gas, anywhere in the state, you would go up and you would look on line 18. The tax is equal to 22.5% of the production. And then you would move ahead and look on page 18, line 10, where it says that the gross value for page 10, when you're calculating, you only use 1/3 of the gross value at the point of production of the gas that is taxable. So if you take the 1/3 there and the 22.5, it comes out roughly to that 7.5. I won't address this, the should we question that you raised there. Next one, page 5, lines 7 through 14. Says lines 7 and 8 say that overpayments can be applied to taxes due for a later month. Lines 13 and 14 indicate that interest is paid on overpayments not refunded. Are we applying taxes to future liabilities or refunding them? Senator Dyson, through the chair, the we're really giving an option to the taxpayer. In other words, if they overpay a month, they can simply wait and the next month pay a little bit less and the two will balance out. They do not receive interest for the amount that they overpaid during that 30-day period. On the other hand, if a taxpayer made some huge error or had suddenly re-estimated and felt they were way overpaid and they wouldn't recoup it for several months, they can apply for a refund, get the cash back, and I believe they have 90 days after they request a refund. If we can get the refund back to them, there's no interest. After the 90 days, the interest clock starts ticking. So if the state, for some reason, it fouls up its process or doesn't get a check out for 6 months, then there will be interest on that refund.
So if they overpay, we charge them, they don't get interest back for overpaying, is that correct?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's correct. In other words, we don't want the state to become a bank. We don't want you pay and you would automatically get interest when it was sitting with the state. The idea is you estimate your taxes as best you can. And so if there's extra dollars with the state, we're not going to pay interest on those.
And if they underpay, we do charge them interest on what they underpaid?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, under the CS in front of you, if they underpay by up to 5%, there is no interest charged. If they underpay by 6%, then the interest will be on the 1%. Uh-huh. So there's a 95% threshold there. As long as they've paid 95% of what's owed, there is no interest charged either.
All right, and please, if I may, restate for me, if they overpay and don't get a chance to use it to offset their subsequent payments, what happens at 3 months and 6 months or whatever it was you mentioned?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, if they request a refund from us,
yep,
and our process can get it out in 90 days, and I believe, Robin's not here, but I believe we generally get them out in less than 90 days, there is no interest. In other words, just mechanically, they ask for the money, we go through, we issue. Well, the reason it takes a while is we have to go through and make sure there isn't an amount owing, or that we agree with their calculations. If we get that refund out in 90 days, no interest. If, however, we can't, if we make a mistake, if it slips between the cracks, if something else occurs, more than 90 days, there is indeed interest.
It goes to them.
The state will then pay interest to the taxpayer.
All right. Thank you for your patience. It takes me a while to understand this. Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. That has generated a question for me. You mentioned the 90%, 95%, but if they only pay 90%, there's no interest. Is there a penalty, however?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, there is the, if they pay 90% of what's due, they would, when they finally settle up, would be paying interest on the 5% difference. We set a threshold of 95. 1 year later, they can true up, and they'll pay the 5% difference, or excuse me, they'll pay the 10% difference, they'll pay everything they owe, but interest will only be due on the difference between 95 and 90.
Thank you. I think I misunderstood what you said initially. There's 95% requirement, and then I thought you said there would be no interest due if they paid up to 90, but then if they paid 89, there would be interest due on that 1%.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, if I said that, I misspoke. The threshold is 95%.
Okay.
So if they only pay 94, they would owe interest on the 1%.
All right, yeah,
difference.
I think you did misspeak, but that clarifies it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Rob.
Yeah, thank you. If I could jump in here, I think I might disagree with Dan on one point. And that is, if during the calendar year there's an overpayment that for which a refund's requested and it takes the department longer than 90 days to refund it, interest would be due. I think that's not the case under this particular provision. Because lines 9 and 10 say that. And I think the rationale is that because of the annual true-up provision the next March 31st, it's not going to be known with confidence what the actual tax liability is until then, and therefore the state should not be paying interest on what looks like an overpayment during that year until we find out for sure. So it's my interpretation that there would not be interest owed by the state on an overpayment unless the overpayment's not refunded within 90 days after that March 31st deadline.
Madam Chair, if I might, Mr. Mintz is absolutely correct. It says, notwithstanding any contrary provision of AS 4305-280, and I was just falling back on the statute. So I apologize for misleading you on that.
Yeah. Thank you, Rob. Next question, we're on, I guess, the next page.
The question is, should there be a comma after the word gas on page 5, line 25?
Yes.
No, I think that just it's just talking about oil and gas, the ownership or right to which constitutes a lessor's royalty interest. It's not a dependent clause for a month other than oil and gas, comma. It's talking about a month other than oil and gas, the ownership of right to which constitutes a lessor's royalty. I don't think it requires a comma. I think that would be the same in the earlier one. It's just a descriptor, I think.
Oh.
We'll find out.
Sounds
we'll
good.
Check with the drafter.
Moving on to page 6, lines 3 through 10, it says, like the Senate Resources CS, the Senate Finance CS deletes the current penalty found in AS 4355-020E for wasteful flaring of gas. And I guess I'm going to have to disagree with that statement, and Mr. Mintz can jump in also. What we did in the statute in both the CS before you and the CS from Senate Resources was change a three-phase, there were three categories of things that could happen to gas in relation to flaring down to a much simpler structure. But if the AOGCC finds that there has been waste, then there is tax due on that gas. In other words, the gas, the exception is if you're using it to produce oil and gas, but if you've wasted it, it is not being used. There is no additional penalty as a consequence of that flaring, that is correct, but AOGCC itself will levy penalties, and those are not affected by the statute. Is that correct, Rob?
Yeah, I think it is.
Is that satisfactory, Senator Dice?
Yes, if I may. So the times when gas gets flared is generally an emergency. Equipment failure, there's needing to get gas out of the pipes or the facilities, and so on. And so I assume for an emergency, we don't charge the company for the flared gas. I suspect we might, if it's not really an emergency, but some kind of an equipment failure that a prudent operator should have precluded, and that's what the AOGC makes a determination on.
Mr. Mintz, if you could respond to that, you probably will do it more accurately than I will.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Bundy, the AOGCC looks at several factors to determine whether flared gas is wasteful or not. And there are several categories of flaring that are kind of presumptively considered authorized. And of course, in an emergency, flaring may or may not be wasteful depending on what caused the emergency. For example, if it were negligent behavior on the part of the operator, it might be wasteful notwithstanding that it's an emergency. But there are these guidelines that AOGC has in its regs, and then it also evaluates on a case-by-case basis after the fact and can classify that flaring as either wasteful or non-wasteful depending on the fact.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the next one I'm also going to refer to Rob. It says on page 8, the CS refers to person, whereas elsewhere it refers to taxpayer, producer, or explorer. Are we confident that person is satisfactorily defined? And Rob, if you don't have the context on page 8 appears to be the reducing a person's tax liability who has purchased a credit.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the answer is there are a couple of reasons. There are a couple of functions that the term person could have. One is it's a shorthand that includes either a producer or an explorer. And the other is that there's really no limitation on who can become a purchaser of a transferable tax credit certificate. It might not be a producer or an explorer. Now it's true that it doesn't do you any good in terms of being able to apply a credit against your tax liability unless you're a producer, because it's only applied against the production tax. However, I think we could envision a situation where there might be intermediaries, brokers, that would buy and sell these certificates.
It seems like when I was in visiting the Senate Resources, you had the conversation about the definition of a person, and it can be a corporation, a business, it's not like just an individual. It has a different meaning, and I don't know if that's defined in statute somewhere or if it's just a widely accepted definition of person.
Well, Madam Chair, it's certainly the intent that it covers a broad range of entities. Actually, I'm just looking at Title I of the Alaska Statutes, Section 0110060, which lists a number of definitions that generally apply throughout the laws, and one of them is person. And that says person includes a corporation, company, partnership, firm, association, organization, business, trust, or society, as well as a natural person.
Is that satisfactory, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I suspected that was the case.
Okay, thank you. Next one?
Madam Chair, page 10, line 9, should there be either an and or after the semicolon, i.e., must the condition satisfy, must the conditions, or I think it means must the company satisfy both conditions or only one? I'm looking at that and believe that that should be, you're correct, there should be an something there, and I believe it is, should be an and. But we can certainly, we'll make sure that's correct. But there should be something that links those two.
Okay. Check with the drafters on that one?
Correct.
Okay. Okay.
Page 17, the next one is page 17, line 6, add an or after the semicolon. That, in fact, is a substantive issue, Madam Chair, which was extensively discussed in the Senate resources. And I think what's appropriate here, and I don't think that anyone has, or I don't have my statute book with me, what's very important is to understand that what 150A does is it sets up three conditions. What it's saying is when the department goes out and looks at costs, the reasonable cost of transportation will be the actual cost. We'll look at actual costs, except, and then it lists three conditions. When the parties to the transportation of the oil or gas are affiliated, when the contract for transportation of oil or gas is not an arm's length transaction or is not representative of the market value of that transportation, or when the method of transportation of oil or gas is not reasonable in view of the existing alternative methods of transportation. Then B, section B says when 1, 2, and 3, and it uses and, when the department finds 1, 2, and 3, then they go and they create their own measure, which will be the market value of that transportation. So if you inserted something here, it would be an and, but what the way the drafting of the statute works is you have to read A and B together. And B says, of those three conditions, here's what happens when 1, 2, and 3 are met. And I think the inference is if 1, 2, and 3 aren't met, then the alternative doesn't apply.
Okay. So they are all additive. You've got to meet all three.
Right. So to be consistent with B, if you think this is not clear, you would add the word and there.
Okay. Check
with
the
probably ought to have the drafter
make
that clear.
Okay.
And then the last question says, Dan Dickinson's presentation of April 20th, the 5,000 BOE. In the first slide relating to the daily production of oil and gas, the slide seems to indicate the producers of oil and gas get two allowances, one for oil and one for gas, while the producers of oil or gas only get one allowance. Let me focus on what that slide, I don't know if folks have that slide in front of them or want to pull
this
that out.
One?
No, it would be the lighter blue presentation. It says PPT Revenue Studies.
April 20th.
What's that?
April 20th.
From April 20th. Let's see if I have it. But looking at that slide, and I see it. Okay, thank you. Looking at that, at the first slide, what you see is there is a 5,000 BOE allowance, Madam Chair, and what that does is it allows you 5,000 barrel equivalent exclusion. So if you have oil only, you would get 5,000 barrels of oil. If you have gas only, you would get the equivalent, which since we're using a 6-to-1 ratio, would be 30,000 cubic feet of gas a day. This chart is perhaps misleading as I tried to simplify things, because I showed, this looks like if you have oil, you get the exclusion on the oil. For a producer that has more than 5,000 barrels, you could think of it as they get the exclusion on the oil and no exclusion on their gas. If I had reversed the chart and put the gas first and everything, it would have shown everyone who had oil and gas as getting an exclusion on the gas. So it's not that it applies to the oil or to the gas, it applies to the barrel equivalents of oil. It's your first 5,000 units that you produce that have a BTU equivalent of one barrel of oil.
If I may, so if what they had was 3,000 barrels of oil and the equivalent, and gas that was the equivalent of 2,000, they get an exclusion on all of it. So it is really the energy content that they get it on. And they don't get it on 5,000 on oil and then 5,000 on the oil equivalent of gas.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's absolutely correct. So if the total barrel of oil equivalent, in fact, I don't believe you can see it on here because it's kind of small, but there is a taxpayer who essentially meets your definition. If you look on F, the top line there is kind of thick. I think that producer produces a couple hundred barrels of oil a day in one of their gas wells. So they exactly meet your situation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir. Okay. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for bringing those forward, the discussion. Yes, sir.
The credit really goes to my staff.
Oh, you didn't do this? Oh, Fred, my goodness. Thank you anyway. Thank you, staff, for bringing up some good points. Okay, Dan, you want to go ahead and begin with what we have today? Does this answer some inquiries from yesterday?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, just for note, we have, the Senate President has allowed us to meet a little extra time this morning, and we'll be going and going on to the floor at 11:30 today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is going to answer all the questions except one, and that was the one question I put on my own to-do list instead of giving it to somebody else, and so it's the one that didn't get done. So, a bad management practice.
Okay, for the record, my name is Sherry Nienheis. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to present these slides. These were basically to answer some questions for further information on various slides that we presented yesterday. The first one was the effect of the tax rate, and we were asked to add to that the status quo. So I added the status quo, that's in the dark blue lines, and it's at $20, $40, and $60. And I also added some data points so it would give you some reference on exactly what these mean. But again, we caution you to not focus so much on the actual numbers, but rather the trends that occur here. And just recall too, on the slide, this was actually the Senate Finance CS with these different tax rates of 22.5% and 25%. They don't represent any other mechanisms in other bills. It's the Senate Finance mechanisms with those different tax rates.
And Madam Chair, if I might make the observation on this, the three dark blue lines represent the status quo at three different tax rates, but the three, the highest of the blue lines would be the equivalent of the top two squiggly lines, if you will. The very top two lines represent at $60 the status the CS before you with a 25% rate and a 22.5% rate for the tax, and that's equivalent to the highest of the blue lines. So you can see it's a dramatic difference. The midpoint, the $40, shows a similar relationship. But interestingly, when you get down to the bottom blue line, it in fact is higher. Status quo line at $20 is higher than this. CS in front of you at either 22.5 or 25%. Mm-hmm. I believe that's true in all years.
Any questions on this graph? Senator Bundy.
So am I reading the graph? Thank you. Reading the graph correctly, that even at 22.5, at $20 a barrel of oil, the state will get a lower return than if we continued the ELF that is everyone acknowledges is broken.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, yes, that's correct. The $20 a barrel oil does yield more under the status quo system than it does under any of the PPT proposals.
But the more predicted rate of 40, then we have a net gain.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, yes, that's correct. And in fact, I don't have the information in front of me, but it's been Roger Marks has testified in the past that We make more in a single year at higher prices to make up for a number of years at low prices.
If I might continue. And as you do these scenarios, you know, one of the basic arguments, discussions we're having is if there are lower taxes, there's more money to invest, there's more production. A question I asked some time back, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, is what would you guarantee us on production, which, of course, no one's able to do that. When you do these scenarios, what production level are you factoring in? Are you factoring in some Ouija board production increase predicated on increased investment, or is this production based on no new investment?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, we have a couple different volume scenarios. This particular one is directly out of our revenue sources book, our spring 2006 revenue sources book production forecast, which is actually put together by our petroleum engineer. He adjusts it pretty frequently, but it comes out at least twice a year, in the fall and in the spring. There's an official forecast. So anytime you see low volume scenario, that is simply our forecast. It doesn't take into account any kind of incentives. We believe that if we do have incentives, we'll have additional production, but we try not to model that. I think that would be, I guess what we try to do is show the effect of the tax and not have the influence of these other factors that could change.
To oversimplify then, the scenarios you give us are sort of worst case scenarios, that what would happen if we don't get increased production, no matter what the new tax rate is.
Senator Bundy, through the
or
chair.
Increased investment, I should say.
Right, and economists will argue, well, if you raise taxes, you're gonna decrease production. If you raise incentives, hopefully you'll increase production. We tried not to model any of those things in here. We tried to have strictly the effect of the tax and how the tax and credits work. And so no, in the low volume scenario, you won't have the effects of any of that. In the high volume scenario, we do include additional volumes we believe will be discovered and produced once we kind of do that in conjunction with the gas line. So our methodology has been, if there is a gas line, there will probably be increased volumes. And so we have a high volume scenario that takes care of that. But mostly we've tried to present the low volume scenario. I think it's more something that people can, we've looked at in the revenue sources book over the years. And it's something that we're more, I guess, more certain of at this time.
Thank you. Anyway, yeah, obviously none of the producers are able to give us any guarantee of future investment. And I'm just wondering if you had any guarantees, but certainty is only coming from our side, not from the other side.
Madam Chair, if I could add one observation to that, Senator Bundy, through the chair. Although it's not on here, if we also showed the governor's bill, in other words, showed this CS with a 20% rate, the rate, mm-hmm. you would also see that same relationship, that at the 40 and 20, it is always higher than the status quo. $20, it will always be lower than the status quo.
Thank you.
Okay, that does concern me a little bit, though, that none of your runs show the impact negatively or positively on future production or future investment. And that's not in any of these?
Madam Chair, I think as Sherry pointed out, what we've tried to do is show the mechanical effect of the tax. There is a relationship, there is no question, between the amount of investment, the amount of production, the amount of tax, the amount of investment. What we don't know, and any economist who, you know, says they know with any certainty, I think has convinced themselves as opposed to convinced other people, that they know that exact relationship. So what we've tried to say is, if we have the high volumes, we'll present you the high volume scenario. If these incentives work, here's what will happen. Here's the production we'll get, the investment we'll get, the taxes we'll get. If these things don't happen, here's what we'll get on the low. I would actually say, with Senator Bundy's early comment, that this isn't necessarily even a worst case scenario. If, for example, investment dried up, we would not meet even the forecast amounts. Continued investment is required for those. So we've tried to show the mechanical effects. What we haven't shown is the macroeconomic effects of how this will play out. But directionally, I think any economist will tell you if you incent behavior, you'll get more of it. If you tax behavior, you'll get less of it. And hopefully we've struck a balance here that will in fact create more investment and, well, and I guess in the sense that the companies don't control the high prices when the high taxes will be kicked in place, we're hoping that will not be a misbehavior that we're not incenting.
But you have calculated in the expected reduction in production of the current wells. Production, okay.
Madam Chair, if I might, I think the whole reason you see a decline down to the left is reflecting what you see in our current sources book.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I think as we've heard several times before, and you know, I was that it's impossible for you to predict that because we hear capital is a very fluid thing, and even if we pass 2020, if another unique opportunity somewhere in the world shows up, capital is going to flow there, no matter what we do.
Senator Bundy, if you pass 2020 and everyone else in the world went out and passed 1030, not a penny would come here.
It's the old see ya. Been nice, but we'll see ya.
Okay. Any more questions on this slide? Okay. Next one.
Okay. The next slide is, again, just a remake of yesterday's slide. This shows the distribution of future cash flows. And I believe I've added two additional scenarios. Well, there's two additional CSs onto this. I've added the Senate Finance CS with 25-25, as was requested yesterday, and also the House Resources CS is in green. And this is just for the years, fiscal year 2007 through 2016. And as you can see, probably the biggest departure from yesterday's graph is that with the House Resources CS, you can see that at about $50 and up above that, the House Resources CS takes off and actually surpasses the Senate Finance CS as currently proposed, and then as at 25-25 at prices above $70, and that's due to the progressivity element in the House Resources CS.
Any questions?
And oh, just to clarify, there's a little asterisk. When we were originally doing these slides, it's sort of a complicated issue, but in the progressive tax that's written into the Senate Resources CS, the way it's written, it's sort of deductible twice. It's a hard thing to explain without seeing it in print, but there's a calculation that has it deductible, implicit in the calculation, and then because it was not specifically noted as that it's not deductible, in addition to that, it shows a double deductibility. What I was asked to do for these slides is to assume that it was deductible only once, and I understand that was what was intended.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Okay, this is the same slide, CS's, the Senate Finance CS with the 25-25 in addition to as it's currently proposed. It's a longer time frame, so it's 2007 through 2030. And what happens with a longer time frame is you actually you get a little bit higher distribution of cash flow to the government. So if you'll compare them with the 2007 through 2016, you'll see a little bit higher numbers on this one. The governor's numbers, the governor's bill numbers, don't go up as much as the other CSs. And the reason for that is that with a longer time frame, you have the effects of the transition and the allowance, which are shorter term mechanisms, they lose their effect over time. So you'll have a greater increase, or you'll have an increase in the longer time horizon. The governor's bill, the increase is less because the standard deduction of $73 million goes all the way through to 2030. Of course, that's price sensitive too, but that would be true at prices above $40. I'm sorry, I misspoke. That is not price sensitive. The transition is.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Okay, moving on to the next slide. This is, again, a fairly old slide. I believe I started it about a month ago, but basically it was the governor's bill with all these different tax rates, and I was asked yesterday to add a tax rate of 22.5-25, which I've done. That's the magenta-colored bar. And as you can see, it's just like yesterday, has a status quo in the black bar running across. These are all at $20, $40, and $60 in low volume scenario. And these are, again, cumulative revenues through 2030. And then the next slide is the same thing, it's just the high volume scenario through 2050. And the high volume scenario, as you know, has about double the volumes, roughly. And it also has, typically, we assume there's a gas line, and the gas line costs are included in the calculation of these.
Upstream gas costs.
I'm sorry, upstream. I need to clarify, not downstream. Upstream gas costs are included in the calculation of these.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Did you say the high volume scenario would be twice the low volumes scenario?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, yes, roughly.
And I'm, if you can help me with that a little, it's my understanding that if we get the increased investment that we're hoping for, we'll just slow the decline. But you're actually saying when you're doing high and low volume, the high volume would be slow decline, the low volume would be maximum decline. Is that what we're looking at?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, yes, there's a number of actual things that take place with production. Prudhoe Bay, of course, if you develop the gas, will have a slightly different production rate. It will decline originally, but it also prolongs the life of Prudhoe Bay. Also, with a high volume scenario, in this particular situation, we assume a gas line. So when you assume a gas line, you have presumably Point Thompson coming online, and you'll have probably more opportunities to explore for additional oil. So we expect that there would be additional currently undiscovered oil found.
If I may.
Go ahead.
And is this in barrels equivalent, or is this in oil and gas, or just oil?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, this is just oil.
Just oil.
And another thing to point out is this is a longer time frame. This is through 2050, 20 years longer than the low volume scenario.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Senator, just to clarify, a lot of the extra volume shows up because of those that additional time period. So in other words, the low volume scenario ends in 2030 when you reach a critical point.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the numbers here that the 20,937, that's at $60. So looking at this chart, for the governor's 2020, you would take the difference of that versus the 55,985 and the 29,37 for the governor's at 22.5 versus 5 at 61,534. Is that the way you read it? So basically, the bottom number is the difference is subtracted for each four of those at $60 from the 29.37.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that's absolutely correct. So for the governor's bill as written with 2020, it'd be roughly speaking a $55 billion difference.
Right.
And then for the next one up, you'd be roughly a 20 from 60
to 40. So at $60, the bottom one is roughly $21 billion, mm-hmm, versus $56 billion, and then $21 billion versus $61.5 $21 billion versus $64.4 billion. So that's how it's read.
Exactly right, Senator.
Right. Thank you. And that's over, and to get that reference, that's over 44 years.
Senator Hoffman, that's correct.
Any further questions on that graph? Okay.
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Oh, yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Dickinson, if you could just go back to the last slide. Is the, as we look at 20 to 40, we get a pretty dramatic change between the bars that are there, and you go to 20, 40 to 60, we get another pretty significant rise. If you go to 80, is it just as, is it as exponential as we're looking, is it looking to be?
Senator Olson,
for the same time period?
Yeah, Senator Olson, through the chair. I think what you'll see, and let me point out one other effect, is at 40, they're closer, and at 60, you see the spread between, say, the governor's bill and the governor's bill. So you'll see, so the two effects you will see, yes, is this, the 80 will be dramatically higher.
Right.
And the increase will be larger than the increase that you saw between 40 and 60, and those spreads will increase so that the governor's bill will you know, the difference between the four will also increase as well as the difference between the prior.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And particularly, if I might make the added observation, actually these are all governor's bills, so there is no progressivity. So the additional progressivity factors, if you had other ones, you would see that changing even more dramatically.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And the next slide.
Okay, in the next slide, I wasn't really asked to prepare, but I thought it was a good analysis anyway. Basically what I did is I took the estimated capital costs. As we have it in our model, we have about, in 2007, we have about a little bit over $1 billion in capital costs. And what I did is I doubled those capital costs. So in other words, in 2007, we have about $22.1 billion in capital costs. And I ran it over these, over the status quo, the governor's bill, the House Resources, Senate Finance, and Senate Resources CSs. And so what you'll see is the dark, not dotted lines, the straight solid lines are as the capital costs are modeled at the lower, about a billion a year, roughly. And this is are the revenues that you have at those costs. And then at the higher costs, those are the dotted lines. And again, the colors, hopefully they look okay on your sheets, they correspond. So in other words, the governor's bill is a red solid line with the expected costs, and the red dotted line is the governor's bill with double the capital costs that we estimated in our model. And we don't, I guess, really believe that we would have double capital costs and not increase production. Again, this is the same production, just assuming doubling of capital costs. So we don't really think this will happen. What I want to do is to show you how the costs could affect the revenues. And probably the most interesting thing to take from this is that even with double capital costs, at prices of over $40 a barrel, we're still better off with the PPT, any of these PPT's possibilities, than with the status quo. Because the status quo line is the dark blue line that runs at the bottom, for the most part, on the far right. And so you can see at about $40, all of those dotted lines are above the status quo.
Madam Chair, if I might use this to actually respond to the question that Senator Bundy asked earlier. And the point is, if our forecast is wildly optimistic, and what is required is a huge influx of capital, and let's just say a doubling of the capital, then this is still the same volumes that are in our forecast, but saying what happens if it requires a lot more capital? And again, I guess on the dotted lines, you'd say, let's assume that the system works and incents that capital is invested, then the revenue figures would shift as you see in this graph. And I think the one point I'd like to make is, in fact, Sherry doesn't know it, but she did model the status quo under both scenarios. But of course, the dotted line is exactly under the straight line of the status quo, so you don't see any difference. The amount of investment that a company makes is irrelevant to the taxes they pay under the status quo. Only insofar as it affects production would it actually change anything.
And so we would read from this chart that, assuming successful bill and a successful reaction from the industry, that there would be increased production, which would maintain current levels. I mean, increase investment, maintain current levels of production. So the dotted lines are the far more realistic lines. I mean, I don't expect double investment, but the dotted lines somewhere below the solid lines are the more realistic projections.
Senator, buddy, through the chair, you probably, the area between the dotted and the solid, it creates the zone in which we'll actually be operating.
Thank you. One other question. I see we're at the end of your charts. I'm still looking for an answer to what delaying the effective date will cost. And if we could do that, I mean, just, you know, if we could even have it a monthly charge, so maybe it gives us some incentive to move ahead.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, if you go back to the material presented yesterday, the three-month change, in other words, an effective date from 401 to 701, we may not be able to find them here, but it's the chart here. It was the very basic chart, a single number on it, which was $418 million.
Which number chart is that?
I apologize, number. We're not numbered. It would be the fourth one from the end.
Thank you.
Again, this is, I requested that folks do graphs on these, so they graphed this data for you. If I might make two observations, the first one is, today, I don't know what today's price is, I didn't check, but yesterday's price was $70.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, that today's price would affect the difference. We're now in this period between 401 and 701. So insofar as that's the case, this would be an understatement if prices stay in that range. At these upper levels that, you know, a lot of dollars get shifted by a $5 or $10 shift. And roughly speaking, if I might also, I believe you could literally divide this by one-third, and I think that would be a fair approximation for the
I'm just guessing
value found in each month.
$125 million a month, every month that we delay implementation.
More $140 million, perhaps, sir.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I'm trying to lowball here.
You're using Gary's figures.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan, I had a question this morning from a person that called and wanted to talk about oil spills and whether they were deductible. And I looked on our summary sheet and it said oil spill deductible, yes, if on lease not precluded, which I didn't understand. So I went to page 20, and that 1920 seems to be the discussion about what can and can't be deducted. Could you help me with that and what that means? Yes, if on lease, and then the word if not, or not precluded.
Senator Wilken, through the chair, yes, and I apologize for the shorthand. I don't have a statute book in front of me, but here's what the current situation is for the deductions downstream. A catastrophic oil spill, which is defined, I believe, as 100,000 barrels or more, or one that the governor declares presents a, I don't have, like I say, I don't have the statute in front of me, but I believe it's a life safety or a, in other words, it has some other aspect that creates a catastrophic need for catastrophic response. Those costs are not deductible. Now, the way that's written currently is it talks about a spill on the marine or inland waterways. In other words, it was, if I looking at the date, I don't think I'm being presumptuous to say it was a response to the Exxon Valdez. And it specifically said that those costs nor the costs associated with transporting the oil or picking, anyway. So in the current statute, with the line being drawn as catastrophic, they are not allowed when you calculate your gross value at the point of production. I would make the observation, that's my understanding, and I only have the same insight that other folks who read the newspapers have, is, for example, the spill that we saw recently on the North Slope would not qualify even volume-wise, leaving aside the other qualifications, nor the when there was the shooting incident a year or so ago. What happened in the House resources is that same language was imported into the deduction for net value. So had a catastrophic spill, which dumped over 100,000 into the inland waterways occurred, that would also not have been deductible. But it was literally the language that was imported over. And again, I may be getting out of my league here and not knowing exactly what constitutes a waterway or a catchment area or anything. But had it occurred on land, there would have been no prohibition on it. That prohibition is not in either of the Senate CSs. So what remains on the statutes is the 100,000 barrels in the inland waterways when you're calculating gross value. Nothing similar is in the CS for upstream costs on the lease. And that's why it said it's not precluded if it's on the lease. Again, reacting to an oil spill or dealing with any such crisis would be considered an ordinary and necessary cost of doing business.
Go ahead.
So it's there's a barrel limit, 100,000. There's a geographic qualifier defined by the governor. Does the on page 20, line 31, I referred the person to costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or negligence. So if we had an oil spill that we would prove was negligent, that would not be deductible. Is that correct?
And I'm going to ask Rob Mintz to step in. I guess that you might have to determine what costs arose from negligence. I'm not sure that the response, if the spill was negligent, but the response that incurred the cost was not, I'm not sure how that would work. So that may be a question for an attorney to parse.
Okay. And the question, I'm sure, is prompted by the current events. You know, one of the companies had that problem. So in regard to that, would the spill that we're dealing with today be deductible?
Madam Chair, may I jump in here?
Please. Yes, you may, Rob. Go right ahead.
A very important point I think we have to keep in mind is that a list of items that are expressly not deductible in AS 4355-160-D2 is not intended to be an exhaustive list. Those are just items that, as a matter of policy, the legislature would be declaring are not deductible, whether or not they might otherwise be direct costs that would be deductible. And so just because an item does not appear on that list does not mean it's necessarily deductible. So, I mean, what I would say is a very general answer is the cost of cleaning up or other costs associated with a spill would be deductible if they are direct, ordinary, and necessary costs of exploring for developing or producing oil or gas, and otherwise they're not deductible. And the committee substitutes simply do not address that question more specifically than that. It would be something that would be determined by the department on a case-by-case basis. And in making that determination, the department would look to the industry practices under joint operating agreement billings as is provided in the bill. And if it's not addressed by those, then the department would have to just make its determination based on basically the meaning of direct, ordinary, and necessary. So I guess I can't predict right now what the outcome would be, but it's not something that's really answered directly yes or no by the current bill.
Rob, does the on line 31, the word negligence, does that allow that latitude for the department to determine whether it's deductible?
Yes, absolutely. I mean that would definitely imply, I believe, that if negligent conduct or omissions led to a spill and which in turn led to a cost, that could be excluded.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Cindy Wilkin. Further questions? We'll be adjourning now and come back at 1 p.m. And I'm requesting that amendments be in today. And I know I have some that are, one from Senator Wilkin, and I have two or three sort of technical from the drafter that I want to go ahead and consider. And if any of you have amendments already, we'll start on those this afternoon. Is there any other information or questions that anyone would like from Mr. Dickinson or Ms. Niehaus? Senator Stedman.
Just a clarification and common corrections. Today we're going to work on amendments and then we'll continue on tomorrow. Is that the plan?
Yeah, and I'd like to get it finished tomorrow if we can.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilkin.
Any word on Econ 1 stuff? Have you heard anything?
No, I have not.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else to come before this morning during this work session? See you again at 1 p.m. for adjournments.